Listener Production.
Australia Today. Honest opinion. Real talk.
Welcome to Australia Today. It is Thursday the 15th of December. Steve Price with you. Natasha Belling with a news update shortly. World Cup final now set. Argentina will take on France. A mouth-watering prospect. 2 a.m. awful time. Monday morning, 1 a.m. in Queensland. We'll catch up with Adam Peacock in just a moment from Code Sports. Parliament's been recalled to Canberra today. That's costing you and me, the taxpayers, $1 million. Airfares, accommodation, Comcars, the lot. And it seems the energy legislation to allow the federal intervention into the pricing of gas and coal will now pass. The Greens have done a deal. A deal that really beggars belief, in my view. Adam Bandt's gotten Labor to agree to accelerate the phasing out of gas in every household in Australia. No detail on how this will happen. No detail on who will pay for it. But Adam Bandt thinks the government will pay to convert your house from gas to electricity. One industry leader estimates the cost of those conversions at $100,000 a house. Just think about it. Anyone listening to me with a gas oven or a gas hot water service would have to convert. And this is where I need your help today, this morning. Can anyone, a plumber, a sparky, is there such a thing as an instant electric hot water system? Let me know on 1300 2399 99. How much would it cost? How hard are they to access? And are they more efficient than gas? Would you be happy in your household to go all electric, the stove, the water, the lot? And would you convert from gas to electricity if you had to pay without the government subsidising it in some way? As with much of this green energy religion, the devil is in the detail. I'll talk to Alan Moran shortly, energy economist, but I'd like your view. Electric versus gas, where do you stand? 1300 2399 99 is our number. You can get in touch, Australia Today at sca.com.au or via Instagram and Twitter. We'll catch up on the World Cup action with Adam Peacock in a moment. First up, though, on this Thursday morning, a very good morning to Natasha Belling.
Good morning, Steve. Let's check the headlines. And as you mentioned earlier, the federal government's energy price relief plan looks all but certain to make it through Parliament today. It's set to see a temporary price cap introduced for both gas and coal, with Independents Jackie Lambie, David Pocock and now the Greens all formally vowing to back it. But opposition leader Peter Dutton is still unsure about the plan, speaking ahead of the special sitting this morning.
We made it clear that we would provide support for a bill which includes relief to people who are seeing their power prices go up under this government. But if the government blends it in with the price mechanism, we are not going to support that bill.
In other news this morning, the father of the two men behind that deadly siege in Queensland earlier this week has broken his silence over the horrific event. Former teachers Gareth and Nathaniel Train and Gareth's wife Stacey ambushed and gunned down the police officers Constable Matthew Arnold and Rachel McCrow at the rural property on Monday. Ron Train believes his sons aren't monsters, saying he just believes his two boys have completely lost their way.
I just could not understand how something like this could have occurred with two children who'd been raised by my late wife Gwen and myself with certain beliefs, Christian beliefs. They'll stand before God for what they've done. They can't be brought to justice now in this world, in the secular world, but they will before God. I have to say I'm sorry. I need to share that with you.
That audio thanks to Channel 9. Overseas now, and a coroner's report has found the death of US sports reporter Grant Wall at the FIFA World Cup in Qatar was health-related. It follows suggestions from his grieving brother, that it could have been foul play. His widow, Dr. Celine Grander, has told CBS Mornings he died of an aneurysm that ruptured.
It's just one of these things that had been likely brewing for years. And for whatever reason, it happened at this point in time.
And you are going to be very busy tonight, Steve.
Please,
the second instalment of Prince Harry and Meghan's tell-all doco series will drop on Netflix tonight. A final trailer has been released this morning, including claims from Meghan that the royals planted stories about her.
You would just see it play out. Like a story about someone in the family would pop up for a minute and they go, I gotta make that go away. But there's real estate on a website homepage. There is real estate there on a newspaper front cover. And something has to be filled in there about someone royal.
Gee, what a shock. The royal family leaking to the media. Who would have thought?
I've got my snacks already ready to watch this
tonight. Yeah, it'll be takeaway food for all of us, I think. Thank you.
No, it won't.
What?
We'll be talking about this tomorrow, and that's not the first time I've heard stories about allegedly the firm leaking other stories to get stop the journalists getting to the real stories.
Well, I'm a royal correspondent, as you know, so I'll have the full detail
for
you.
We're in the 80s.
Tomorrow. Thank you. Natasha Belling back at the bottom of the hour. Adam Peacock joins us. We now have our dream final, I guess, France and Argentina, Adam, but the dreams of Morocco gone.
Yeah, morning, Steve. And by the way, I can't wait to not watch that tonight with the Royals. But anyway, we move on. Good on focus on the football, shall we?
We will.
The Moroccans, fantastic story. And look, they threw everything at France this morning. France are this weird side that they've got all these highly paid, high-profile players, but they come up with tradesman-like performances. It's nothing flash, and then bang, one of their heroes or one of their big stars does something brilliant, and then they're ahead in the game, and then they're 2-0 up, and Morocco will probably turn around this morning going, we outplayed them for long stretches. But yeah, the fairy tale story is over, and we've got ourselves Mbappe v Messi, France v Argentina to decide it all on Sunday night.
Only problem is it's 2 o'clock in the morning, but we'll have to put that to one side. Most of us are probably going to be on holidays, me included, so why not get up and have a look? You're the first one to alert me, Adam, to Mbappe and how good he is. And since you did that, I've watched a couple of times, and boy, he's a Rolls Royce. I was talking to Waleed Ali about it, who's a huge soccer fan. He agrees with you that this guy could be the best in the world.
If his body holds up, like his game is built on his acceleration and his ability to make an opponent look very, very slow, very, very quickly. And that's what he's been like since the age of 19. Now, if he cops a couple of injuries, that slows him down. It's not like a Messi who has got this brilliant understanding of the game. He can think his way through. More down the path of Ronaldo, who has made himself into a footballer on the basis of his physical gifts, and he's improved on them. Now, Mbappe, with the ball at his feet, is very, very good. I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is that he's blinking an eye. Ability to turn a game, like the quick movement today to shake off his opponent Hakimi, who he plays with at PSG in Paris, to turn and then open up space. That very few can do that in that amount of time and that amount of
pity space. We're not going to see him play EPL or Serie A or in Spain, isn't it?
Yeah, he might end up in Spain because he grew up a Real Madrid fan, but I can't see PSG letting him go. As long as they're owned by the Qataris and they've got all the money in the world that they do have, he'll be given what he needs there in Paris to furnish his lifestyle, put it that way.
Got to love the French blaming England for their players getting the flu.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yes.
Look, it is going around absolutely everywhere over there. And a lot of the Australian journalists, I've been one of the very few that have come back and been okay, but people going down with influenza A and desert flu, they call it, and COVID as well. It's flying around everywhere over there. But now the French looked okay. They looked like they'd taken their butter menthols this morning, put it that way.
Who wins?
Oh, I think Argentina, actually. I think that the way that Argentina can make it into a scrap, and if France are going to be passive like they were for very long periods of time this morning, I think Argentina can come up with the moments and ride the emotional wave that they'll have behind them in a 90,000-seater stadium predominantly filled with Argentinians.
Wanting to give a World Cup to Messi.
Yeah, that's the accusation that everyone says, oh, it's set up for Messi, but France are good enough to spoil that on any given day, but I just think Argentina.
Croatia, Morocco, who wins that?
Oh, yeah, they'll probably all play their second teams to give everyone a go. But probably the Moroccans, they'll want to aim up for all their supporters there in Doha. So they played really well this morning, and Croatia were well off against Argentina. So on the basis of the two semi-finals, I think Morocco on that one.
So much. Thanks so much for your help through the tournament. It's been wonderful to be able to talk to you both in Qatar and back here in Sydney. Good on you, Adam.
Thanks, Steve.
Good on you, mate. Adam Peacock from Code Sports. Well, as we heard out of Canberra yesterday, the Greens have done a deal with the government to get their energy legislation up. Parliament recalled today, one day only, costing the Australian taxpayers $1 million. The devil's always in the detail with these things, though. And what stood out to me was this idea, prosecuted by the Greens, that every house in Australia that has instant gas hot water ought to change to electric hot water. Now, I started thinking about that overnight, and I'm thinking about myself, I've got instant gas hot water. How would I convert to electricity? How much would it cost me? Who's going to pay for it? And in the end, is my hot water cheaper or more expensive? Now, Adam Bant went on the Today Show, on Sky, I should say, with Peter Stefanovic this morning, and Peter demanded that Bant started to tell him about the cost, not the savings. Have a listen.
Right, but not the savings, the cost.
And that's been estimated. The estimated savings for households have been estimated up to $1,900. And some have estimated that if you fully electrify your house, you could save up to $3,500 a year. Now, the costs of doing that are really the costs of the appliances and switching over. And if we can find a way for government to meet those costs and chip in and do it and make it zero cost for the householder and the business, that's what we want to do.
So Bant wants taxpayers to pay for every house in Australia, every apartment, every unit, and every business to convert to electric. How much does he think that's going to cost, and where's the money going to come from? Alan Moran is an energy economist, talks more sense about these things than anybody else. Alan, are you staggered like me about this stuff?
Not really. I think it's typical. We've been seeing the utter destruction of the electricity and the gas markets as a result of regulations, and Bant is just trying to prove that he's even more radical than Albanese with pulling numbers out of the air to say, well, it's all going to save us $3,000 of this money, dollars, whatever, with nothing to back them up at all. I mean, what we've seen is the slow destruction of the energy market by the sorts of regulations that are being introduced now and being exacerbated by the price caps. And we're actually seeing the result of this is massive increases in prices, and those increases in prices and reductions in reliability will continue on. This is just a certain amount of floss there to try to justify doing even more. The outcome will be a disaster for Australian consumers and for Australian industry, which is being a slow-moving disaster for the last 5 or 6 years, and we'll start accelerating now.
People, as you and I both know, Alan, people don't hear the detail. They're too busy to engage. They're going about their business, going to work. They think, oh, yeah, electric, that might work better than gas. Someone else will pay for it. The government will pay for it. Well, no, they won't. And, in fact, what was announced yesterday was Chris Bowen talking about how we might get loans to change our houses. But just on a quick Google search by me, and I know that's not the best research, but we've been able to work out that the cost to run an electric instant hot water system for a house with four people is estimated to be around $970. $1,115 for electric storage hot water service. But if you've got a gas system, it's actually cheaper. Who's going to blow up their gas hot water service to pay more money every year?
Yeah, well, I am. If somebody else paid me to do it, and if somebody gives me a big subsidy, and this is the answer. It's very easy to see, as you've just shown, that the existing system is cheaper. If it wasn't, people would voluntarily move to the other system. What we're actually seeing in a whole raft of areas is the government saying the renewable energy converted into electricity is the cheapest form of energy, so we're going to subsidise it. It makes no sense at all. Basically, all of these the goal is to switch to electric and then have all the electric powered by solar or wind, which, you know, won't work. It will be extremely expensive, but it's all kind of just part of the zeitgeist, the sort of ideology which is being processed through politics at the present time.
Yeah, and even Bowen was silly enough to suggest, oh, well, we would compare the conversion of your home to electricity to the subsidies we're giving you to buy an electric vehicle. Well, if the electric vehicles are so fantastic, why do you have to subsidise me to buy one?
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot to be said about electric vehicles, but yeah, subsidising them is paying the rich. And, you know, really, it makes no sense, certainly from a Labour Party politician's point of view, to say that. Yeah, we're just doing this throughout. We're sort of people being driven by an ideology, which I guess comes back to climate change and whatever in the end, to spout lies about, you know, this will be cheaper. And not only will it be cheaper, it'll be even cheaper because we're going to give it you free. As though the government has any money to give. The government's only got money that it can take from other people.
You and I laugh about it, but, I mean, the serious side of this is, of course, that the government is so desperate to get this bill through to cap gas and electricity prices $125, I think, a tonne it is on coal, and and they're going to cap the gas price as well. They're so desperate to get that through the parliament today, and they needed the Greens' votes, that Bant wanders in, it seems to me, and I'm, you know, I'm making this up, but I can see it unfolding. Bant wanders in and says, we'll agree as long as you get everyone to get off gas. Well,
yeah.
The average Australian goes, oh, hang on, why is gas not as good as electricity? And doesn't electricity need me to burn coal to make it? And, you know, what are you doing?
Well, I mean, you know, he's saying, essentially what he's saying is that electricity is all emission-free because it's all going to be generated by wind and solar, which is absolute rubbish. It couldn't possibly happen. And whereas gas does have these emissions, so we'll get people off gas and we'll reduce our emissions and get some plaudits from people around the world for wrecking our economy by reducing our emission levels. Now the actual whatever Bant has got, it probably it's a bit loose because I don't think the government's going to give him very much in there. It'll review this until nothing happens. But he's basically standing on a podium saying, "Look, I'm even more radical than Albanese. Therefore, you know, keep on supporting me." But the end product is we actually start destroying the economy. Energy is the most important thing. Cheap energy is even more important than anything else. And we actually are destroying the cheap energy as a result of the price caps are just the icing on the cake in the case of this destruction. And the measures that the Greens are calling for is further froth on that icing.
The crazy thing, just finally for me, you and I are old enough to remember when we had those big water tanks that you had to heat up with electricity overnight to get your hot water. And if you had any friends or relatives come and stay, you had to say, oh, you can only have a shower for 2 minutes because we'll run out of hot water. Remember those days?
I do remember those days. In fact, a lot of people still got such tanks and maybe they will convert them to the instant hot water eventually. But, you know, you don't just destroy what you have. To make a minor saving, you gradually make the savings through more efficient appliances.
It's unbelievable. The Canberra bubble strikes again. Alan, thanks for your time. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Alan Moran there, energy economist. Will you convert your house from gas appliances to electric if you have to pay yourself, or do you want the government to pay? Adam Bant's done a deal with the government. Peter Van Onselen is Network 10's political editor and joins us on the line. The million-dollar parliamentary recall starts today. Do you understand this deal the Greens have done?
Not entirely, I have to be honest. I've had a close look at what they're asking for, and it seems like it's a mixture of things into the future as well as promises that Anthony Albanese won't do certain things which the legislation doesn't even entail. In other words, they don't want him to provide subsidies down the track to big business, but in not providing those subsidies, they haven't got a guarantee. In a sense, they've just got a verbal undertaking, and you never know because that doesn't require legislation anyway. So the mix of what they're asking for is partly contained in the legislation that they've compromised on, but it's also partly sort of crystal ball gazing as well.
So do you have a gas instant hot water system at your house?
I certainly do. Well, I've got two, actually, because we didn't want one to affect the other between upstairs and downstairs. I probably shouldn't have shared that.
So I've got the same, and most people listening to us no longer have that big tank that used to either, if you're in an apartment, sit in a cupboard, or if you had a house like where I grew up with my folks, we had it out the back, at this big round cylindrical tank full of water, and every night a coil powered by electricity would heat the water up and then you'd use it for showering. And if you ever had anyone come visit, you ran out of hot water after about the third person shower. And you had to tell people they could have to limit the amount of time in the shower. Are we going back to that, are we?
Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? I mean, I remember thinking that the gas instant heatings were revolutionary, not just because, you know, you don't run out of hot water, as you mentioned, although that's obviously the convenience part, but also it struck me as efficient. I just assumed it was efficient because it meant that you didn't have this permanently hot, you know, massive tank all hours of the day. It just sort of sparked the heat when you needed it.
I mean, think about this too. I mean, you and I think about things practically. I don't think sometimes people like Adam Bant do think practically. So what they want us to do, they want us to all get rid of petrol engine cars and buy electric vehicles. They want us to get rid of our instant gas hot water and go electric. So suddenly the grid, which is going to be powered in the green nirvana by wind and solar, is going to have to generate enough storable electricity to power every electric vehicle in the country and every household's hot water system at night.
You know what part of that is? That's the law of unintended consequences that they don't think about. And I think there's two levels to it. The first one is just the transition costs alone. In terms of the energy cost of the transition costs, much less what it means for the grid or what it means for the economy. But then the other one is, when you do make these adjustments, you then put pressure on other parts of the energy structure, which is going to cause its own problems down the track. We've already seen that in other spheres. So governments do this all the time. Minor parties aren't in government most of the time, so therefore they're perhaps even more inclined to lose the practical because they don't have the consequences of government failure. But that law of unintended consequences, Pricey, you just see it time and time again in policy decision-making.
Have a guess what happens when you have a blackout too. So if you've got gas, you can cook your dinner because you've got candles and a gas stove. You have a blackout, no one's got gas, no one eats.
No, you lose all of that as well.
Are we allowed to have gas on our barbecues, or is that going to be banned as well?
I don't know what I've missed here, but my understanding was that the policy decision makers and the experts about energy transition plans, they were always telling me when I'd interview them that gas was an incredibly important transition fuel before we go entirely renewable at whatever point down the track that becomes economically viable, which it will one day, but it's just probably further away than people realise. But gas was always meant to be the transitional option because it was much cleaner than things like coal, but didn't get you all the way to renewables. Well, what happened to that discussion?
So Adam, Angus Taylor, I should say, in Canberra this morning, saying that the deal with the Greens is disgraceful and this whole process is flawed. He said, we're being asked to vote today on a bill we hadn't seen until late last night, which is extraordinary. He said it was still being baked yesterday afternoon. It's come out completely undercooked. I'm not sure if I like all that fancy language, but anyway. He said, now we know that to get this through the parliament, Labor's done a sweetheart deal with the Greens. We don't know how much they've given them, but we do know the Greens passed or approved the legislation. This is like the buyer of a house coming in and buying the house without ever having seen it. This is what the Greens have done. He makes a reasonable point.
No survey, no nothing, no building check as well. Can I add this point, Pricey? I think this is really important. The rush to get this legislated, even if they had more time, like let's assume that they decided to have a few sitting days, they decided to give them another week, all of which they're not doing. Even if they did all of that, the rush to legislate it before Christmas is purely political because the government said they would have a solution by Christmas, so they want to be able to have a solution by Christmas. But in terms of what will be enacted out of the legislation, it doesn't take effect until the second quarter of next year. So there is absolutely no legislative reason that this couldn't wait until the normal return of Parliament in February next year. And that would have two clear benefits. One would obviously be it gives more time to actually review it all, to debate it, to debate amendments potentially to improve legislation. But it would also mean that you don't have that expense of everybody turning up in Canberra, staffers as well, and all the rest of it for one sitting day. It's a meaningless political exercise. That point has to be made because that's all this is about. You know, otherwise, they could be back there in February doing the exact same thing, but a little bit better because there's more time for scrutiny.
I tell you, the bloke who really worries me in this government is Energy Minister Chris Bowen. He's been out today suggesting the federal government had been considering offering household incentives to switch from gas to electricity for months. So he said that because he doesn't want the Greens to be seen to have scored a win. He said consultation on the National Energy Performance Strategy, whatever the hell that is, began a few weeks ago with the consultation paper stating more can be done to assist low-income households to improve the energy performance of their home. That smacks to me of, okay, if you are on a lower income or you're on benefits, the taxpayer is going to pay to convert your house from electricity to gas.
Yeah. Well, and how feasible is that in terms of the not just the finances of it, but the reality of getting it done when we have skill shortages right across trades at the moment, which also goes, by the way, to their whole plan of emissions reductions by 2030. I think we've talked about this before. On Chris Bowen's own estimates, so this isn't some estimate by a body that's cynical or critical of his chances of getting there. On his own estimates, if he wants to achieve his 2030 emissions target, Australia over the next 8 years or so needs to install 20,000 solar panels a day. That's not a year or a month, a day,
what?
Every day. So if we install 10,000 one day, we've got to install 30,000 the next to keep pace. And, Pricey, we need to do 40 wind turbines a month, you know, those massive wind turbines. We're going to be falling behind those KPIs day in, day out, month in, month out. And as a result, it sort of highlights that the target for 2030 is a myth.
Incredible stats those are, Peter. Can I just say thank you very much for your help this year. It's been fantastic. You work on Australia Today and on the 10 Network. It's always a pleasure to catch up and pick your brain, mate. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, mate. Been a pleasure talking to you.
Good on you. Peter Van Onselen. Taking your feedback, is there such a thing as an instant electric hot water system? I'd like the answer to that. Would you be happy for your house to go all electric? Would you convert from gas to electricity if you had to pay for it? Pat said, for those of us in regional Australia that suffer blackouts, there's no way I would swap electric cooking from gas. During the February floods, and this is the point I made, and this is the point Pat's making, during the February floods, there was no power for 4 days. If we didn't have gas to cook, it would have been even worse. Michael said there are many towns across the country that don't have mainline gas, many. And Ben Up, Albanese and Bowen will stuff this up big time. Dean said, absolutely not. The Greens are out of control. They've never had a real job. Australia needs gas. That's a good bumper sticker. Australia needs gas. I might invest in that.
And 67,000 students across New South Wales are waking up to their HSC results this morning. The state's education department says marks have remained pretty consistent across the board, despite widespread natural disasters like the recent floods and the ongoing COVID crisis. New South Wales Education Minister Sarah Mitchell says students have overcome a lot of challenges recently, especially during their senior years.
But the class of 2022 have performed really well, and in a consistent way with other year groups. So a big congratulations to them, but also their teachers, their principals, their support officers at school, and of course their friends and parents who I'm sure have helped them along the way as well.
Very nervous morning for a lot of students across the country, Steve.
Indeed. How'd you go with yours?
Oh, I did really well, and I was so surprised,
what
actually.
What was your rater?
It was very good.
Very
I'm not gonna,
good.
I don't want to put the pressure on my kids.
But hang on. I didn't finish school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've done a lot better than me. You don't be embarrassed about it.
No, I'm just saying I
did. Even if you only did get 35 in your ATAR.
I did work incredibly hard. That's the thing. So I never criticise anyone for their results as long as they put the effort in. But when I got my result, it was in the post that I ended up driving my dad's beautiful, precious car and took out the pole.
When the postman was on a horse, used to drop letters off at your farm. And you went out barefoot to pick up.
After it took me 20 Ks to walk to school with no shoes.
That's the one.
After I'd milked the cows.
But you did do well. Your ATAR was so good that you got into journalism school, which is
I did in Bathurst. It hasn't to work with you, Steve.
Don't you wish you'd done a little better? Might have been able to avoid that. Tasha and I talk a lot about COVID in 2022 and 2021. It's still around. In fact, some of the numbers around are frightening. Now, we've got doctors warning that the nation's hospitals are heading toward a crisis during the Christmas period with a new wave of COVID infections. You don't need to be a genius to know that. And indeed, an ED specialist, an emergency department doctor, I heard on radio in Melbourne last week, said every emergency department in Melbourne was overrun. Professor Mark Stube is the Burnett Institute Head of Public Health. He's been kind enough to join us. Thanks for your time, Professor.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be with you.
Politicians are trying desperately to pretend it doesn't exist anymore, it seems to me.
It's interesting. Message around COVID exceptionalism and trying to remove COVID exceptionalism has crept into the lexicon. The fact is that the numbers indicate that COVID still is an exceptional disease, a respiratory virus in Australia. We're still getting over 15,000 cases notified a day, which is likely to be a significant underestimate for people who can't access RATs or don't report their RAT results. It's still creeping up. You know, there's an 8 to 10% increase, on the previous period. It is absolutely still around.
So from a policy point of view, and you're an expert in public health, Melbourne, Victoria at one point went into lockdown with 4 or 5 cases. We've now got 15,000 cases nationally a day. No one's got an appetite for lockdowns anymore. We know that. But surely there's a more sensible middle ground than just make out it's not here.
Yeah, look, I think there is. You know, we're well past those lockdown phases, and that was a really effective tool when we didn't have vaccines. Australia was incredibly successful in reducing the number of deaths in the early phases of the pandemic when we didn't have vaccines. The public health measures such as lockdown was basically all we had. Now in this post-vaccine period, you know, there are a range of, you know, what I would describe as harm reduction mechanisms that can be employed. Still, high quality masks are really important indoors and in crowded locations, and also ventilation. You know, those are the two key things at the moment that we can really focus on to try and reduce the spread or slow the spread and take that pressure off our hospital systems, as well as to, you know, take care of ourselves and our loved ones as well over this Christmas period.
I hear the odd ad saying you should wear a mask, but I don't see politicians out there publicly urging you to do it. I'm increasingly seeing masks. My two colleagues in the studio here are masked this morning, but I got on got into a lift with someone this morning wearing a mask. But I travelled to Sydney on a plane on Tuesday. Probably 2 or 3 people on that whole plane had a mask on. There I am for an hour and a half in an aluminium tube with not many people masked. So the message is very, very confusing for people, I think.
Yeah, I think it. I would really like to see both the Commonwealth and jurisdictional governments invest in a little bit more health promotion. Similar to you, I was on a couple of flights the last couple of weeks, and again, yeah, I was one of only, you know, 3 or 4 people on the plane with a mask. You know, the ventilation in planes is generally pretty good. The exchange of air in aircrafts is great. What I would really encourage people, though, is it's very high risk when you're boarding and getting off planes, you know, before the engines are fired up and before that ventilation system is going. But look, I would just really encourage people at the moment, when the numbers are what they are and leading into Christmas, you know, I would really encourage people to wear a high-quality mask indoors if you're going to a shopping centre or you expect to be in a crowded location.
Yeah, so I've got an 88-year-old mother flying from Adelaide to Melbourne on Monday. Would you be telling me to tell her to invest in a proper mask?
Oh, absolutely. My mother is 90. And I take all the precautions I can around Mum. I encourage her to, you know, she only really goes out shopping once a week. She always wears, you know, a high quality mask, and, you know, I bring those masks up for her. I do a RAT test before I go and visit her, and I encourage my family to do so as well. So it's the message, I guess, I would like to get out to the community is to know your risk, but also know the risk of others around you. And, you know, particularly at this time, you know, this Christmas is going to be special for a lot of people. You know, the last, you know, few Christmases have obviously been significantly disrupted. So, you know, people are going to be really keen to spend a family Christmas together. So, but there's a range of things that we can do to try and make that as safe as possible. And they don't have to be major disruptors at all. You know, it's just really about taking care of those around us.
Just finally, given what we've just discussed, were you a little surprised on Monday when Health Minister Mark Butler released that National COVID Health Management Plan, which included the fact that PCR tests were now not free, and from next year you're going to have to get your doctor to give you a referral to go and get one?
Yes, I was a little surprised. I would prefer that decision not to have been made. I think one of the issues at the moment is equity. One of the things that we've seen during the pandemic is people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, those in casual jobs, you know, those that, yeah, you know, come from, you know, marginalised places in the community, bore an unequal burden of COVID. And we're seeing that now as well. You know, what's happened is that the government has shifted responsibility or COVID onto individuals, but not really provided individuals with the tools to protect themselves. You know, this decision is, you know, I don't necessarily agree with it. I don't think it's particularly with the numbers as high as they are. But it's also forcing people into using RATs, which a lot of people can't afford. And, you know, you really, if you're unwell, you want to test with a RAT multiple days, you know, when you've got symptoms. And at that cost, for people on low incomes, it's just not affordable for them. So if you're going to bring in a decision like this, I would very much like to see the subsidisation or, you know, making RATs free and making high-quality masks free for people on low incomes. I think, you know, if the government is going to shift burden onto individuals, then I think it's incumbent upon governments to also support individuals with the tools to help them protect themselves and others.
You talk so much sense, Professor. Thanks very much for helping us out today.
No worries. Thanks, Steve.
The Burnett Institute Head of Public Health, laying it on the line there, Professor Mark Stube. Taking your feedback, 1300 2399 99. Get in touch via Instagram or Twitter. Would you convert if you had to pay? Scott Phillips, Chief Investment Officer for Motley Fool. Are you happy to convert your entire house to electricity?
Steve, good morning. So funnily enough, mate, I'm getting a bloke come out next Monday to quote me on replacing our instantaneous gas with a heat pump option. So I don't know.
What
I
is
might
that?
Have a better answer for you. Oh, I don't know the technology. It basically works like a reverse fridge. It sucks heat from the outside of the unit and heats the water on the inside. Apparently, it's more efficient and cheaper than gas and the old, you know, the
Are
old
you doing this because
system.
You're a closet greenie, or you're doing it to
no,
save money?
Save some money. A bit of both, actually. So I'm not about closet greenie. I'm very keen to do something on climate change.
You do drive around in a Toyota Land Cruiser, so you're hardly
no,
a greenie.
Hilux, pretty nice. Yes, no, there is that. Mate, no, so look, I think I would like to think we can do something better for the environment. Here's why I'm doing it, honestly, is apparently it's much cheaper to run than gas. We also have solar panels on the roof that actually put out more energy than we use. So it should be cheap for me on both angles. So that's honestly, I don't know if I'll do it. I'm getting a quote on Monday. The guy will say it'll cost this much. I'll be either, yeah, great idea, or no, I'm not doing that. So I think if it makes economic sense and it makes environmental sense, then there's some positives to it. I hope it might save me a few bob. So that's honestly the motivation.
As usual, John, Adam Band says he wants the government to pay. So you won't have to pay. So maybe you should wait. Get Adam to do it. Get Adam Band to come out and give you a quote. The quote will be, it won't cost you anything, Scott. It'll cost the taxpayer.
It drives me a bit mad. The solar panel thing, it's crazy. I reckon solar panels for most people, and it depends on where you are and what shading you've got and what sun you get. Solar panels are stupidly, stupidly great value for most people, because the ROI on these are normally something like 4 or 5 years. In other words, once you've had 4 or 5 years on the roof, after that, you're in clover. You're more than paid for it, and then you make a lot of money. It depends on the house, so don't take this for gospel. Go and get your own quotes. But there's some really, really great money-saving things you shouldn't need government support to do. You might need to do some financing. There's probably an argument to say get the energy companies to you know, help the transition, or maybe there's some interest-free or low-interest loans to make it doable. Some banks are doing green loans at the moment, for example. But these are just smart financial decisions. I think that's the other thing is, you know, Bant's got his own agenda, and that's fine. But honestly, people who are listening just from a purely financial perspective, go and have a look at panels, go and look at heat pumps. It'll cost you some money up front. Not everyone's got that money up front. I think we can probably help people economically as well as environmentally make those changes. But I don't reckon the government should be paying shouldn't be paying my fee, mate. I can afford to do it. I should do it on my own bat, but also save some money, and most people will.
What do you reckon it's done to your quarterly power bill in terms of savings?
Oh, the panels, mate. I get paid money over about the 5 or 6 months, probably 5 months of summer. Actually, I have a net credit on my account. In winter, you know, it costs more, obviously, because there's just less sun, there's lower in the sky. It's probably, over the year, probably dropped it by at least 3/4, mate, probably more.
And have you got a particularly expensive system up there, or is that one that a normal household could afford to put on?
No, yeah, it's just standard panels. In fact, the panels, the only downside of doing it, I did it 6 years ago, and the panels these days are the same price, but they actually are much more efficient. So I think I can get something like 60% more power per panel if I replace. I won't replace it, it's not worth it. But if I was doing this from scratch now, I'd save even more because the number of panels on the roof, I generate even more electricity, or I could generate the same and have fewer panels, which cost me less. But either way, the returns on them just keep going up. It's really, really impressive.
You'll have me driving an electric car if you keep talking. the US Fed, they're going to keep putting up the interest rate. Yep. Yesterday, we were talking about how inflation had started to dampen there. So how come?
They want to make sure. It comes down to, you know, what else they need to do to get inflation back to where they want it. So it's dropped from 7.7 to 7.1%, and their view is that it won't go from there down to 2 or 3% without extra effort, without extra work. I think it probably makes sense at some level to kind of keep, you know, keep just applying a bit more pressure to keep spending low, because what they don't want is the challenge of raising rates. They've done it so much already, particularly here in Australia, right? We're up to 3.1% official cash rate. The Yanks are higher than that. But if they don't go higher and inflation does rebound, then you've got the worst of both worlds. You've got high inflation and high rates, which would be terrible for the economy. So I think they're of the view that you're in for a penny, in for a pound. Now they've done this. Now they've created the pain they've created economically. They've got to make sure they end up with the outcomes they absolutely are targeting. Otherwise, you end up with the worst of both worlds. So that's why they're doing it. How much is too much? There's an old axiom in economics. The last rise.
Might have lost Scott's line there, I think. First photographs are released today of the school teacher and mother of two, Stacey Train, who was involved in that police execution in Queensland in the town of Weambilla. Now, a lot more detail has started to come out. Apparently, along with her husband and brother-in-law, she ran from the home with a firearm before being shot by heavily armed specialist officers. So this is after the two police officers were executed. Now, Stacey Train is a former teacher and school principal. Can you believe it? Once worked with disadvantaged children. Stacey, her husband Gareth, and his brother Nathaniel were shot dead by special emergency response team on Monday night. That property, by the way, apparently had a whole bunch of secret cameras installed so that the three that have executed the police officers were able to watch who was coming in from what direction. Two crews arrived at that home at 4:30 Monday to make a routine inquiry, and we know then what happened. When police approached the house, the trio opened fire, killing Constable Matthew Arnold and Constable Rachel McCrow. They also shot and killed the neighbour, Alan Deere. His wife has been on Nine this morning, claiming that his body was left on the side of the road. Another officer, Constable Randall Kirk, shot in the leg, got back in the police car and escaped. There's now pictures of that police car with bullet holes in it. So they even fired on that car as Constable Kirk tried to get away. And we know that Constable Keely Brough, 8 weeks out of the academy, ran into the bush and hid. The Trains then set fire to flush her out. We were told yesterday that that property also contained a large number of snakes. It is a horror story that unfolded up there this week in an awful way.
And the most complained about ads of 2022 have been revealed, with the top spot going to PointsBet for their ad starring NBA legends Shaquille O'Neal and comedy duo The Inspired Unemployed. Paris Hilton's Uber Eats campaign with the Irwin family also saw a lot of complaints. People thought it was violent due to a scene that suggested a snake had eaten a little dog. Richard Bean from Ad Standards says its panel investigated around 250 ads this year, with one in five breaching the rules.
The top issue of concern this year was about sexual appeal and nudity, followed by violence, and then followed by discrimination or vilification. In terms of advertising mediums, more than half of the complaints we received this year were about ads seen on free-to-air TV, followed by Instagram with about 10% of complaints.
Oh, I so agree about Shark O'Neal.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Or whatever his name
is. Are you calling him
Shark O'Neal? It drives me crazy every time he turns up. Imagine what he was paid to do that.
Yeah, I know.
The frequency of those ads, the ads spend.
Look, maybe we're old school, Steve, but I remember the ads that you would remember. They were really great ads. I couldn't think of any ads now currently that I'm thinking, wow, that's a great ad that I want to go and buy that product.
If I thought long enough, I probably would, but that one and the Irwin thing with Paris Hilton, give me a break.
I know.
And who's that rapping bloke who tells me to get food delivered by someone on a bike?
Gay Grandpa.
Who?
But you don't even use it. What's his name? It's a great song. See, this is what I mean.
The rap artist, man.
Yeah. We don't even know what the ads are. Do you know I used to work with Richard Bean?
Who's he?
He's a lawyer. And I remember I always did not want to be in his office because that meant I was in trouble.
50 Cent, was that who it was? Who was the man who did the...
I think with inflation he's now known as a dollar.
Shaquille O'Neal's the basketballer. Who was the rapper who did the Food R Us ad?
Like, no, it's not Food R Us, Steve.
What is it?
It's Uber Eats.
Uber Eats. No, no, I think he was the other one.
Was he?
Yeah. Anyway, see, the advertising obviously clearly doesn't work because we can't remember his name or the...
It's Snoop Doggy Doggy.
Snoop Dogs. That's him.
Snoop Dogs.
Snoop Dogs telling me to get some poor kid paid $4 an hour to deliver a cold pizza on a motorbike.
This is like listening to my grandparents talk.
I mean, seriously. Why would you want that?
And I need to call you out straight away now. And off-air conversations now going on air.
What?
Yes. That I gave you a lovely gift for Christmas.
A mudgy food hamper.
That I had to pay for, which is important.
And I know why you're now doing it on air.
And then,
because you know my mother listens.
And then you said, oh, I like that. I've gone into the Secret Santa and I've got my mother and I don't know what to buy her. Oh. And I said, I'll give you a couple of lovely tips. Then you said, what?
Maybe I could repurpose the hamper.
Re-gift. So you're a re-gifter.
I am, actually.
Doesn't surprise anyone bit.
Thank you very much. Natasha, back, bottom of the hour. Speaking of Christmas gifts, something that I'd never ever thought about. What happens in war when Christmas comes around? Well, certainly back in World War One in 1914, it was very different. Matt McLaughlin is one of Australia's best war historians, founder of Battlefield Tours. We talked to him on a regular basis. So they downed guns and did what exactly, Matt?
Well, g'day, Steve. Yes, it's probably the last time of the year we'll get to talk about these things, but a good one to end on. Hopefully a little bit of humanity in the middle of all the horror of the First World War. So this only applied in the first Christmas of the First World War, so in December 1914. And in some parts of the line on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, they did put down their weapons and various levels of fraternisation occurred. So it might have simply been a no-firing policy where for the day they wouldn't shoot at each other, all the way up to enemies actually meeting in no man's land and exchanging gifts. So quite a remarkable
gee, you'd have to be trusting, though, wouldn't you? You spent the previous 3 months trying to kill a bloke on the other side of the trench and then suddenly you put a bit of holly in your hair and walk up out of the trench and say, g'day, mate.
Yeah, I agree. The first bloke to stick his head above the parapet, literally stick his head above the parapet and not get shot at was a pretty brave bloke. But it's really interesting because I think what we're mostly talking about is the British and French troops and the German troops on the Western Front. And a lot of the Christmas traditions that we know about actually started in Germany. So Christmas trees and a lot of Christmas carols. And so I think that there was a real feeling from the Germans that Christmas was something that should have been celebrated and the Allied troops responded.
That was 1914. It changed by the time the Australians got there, though. So you get fast forward to 1916, and one of my one of the great Australian heroes, Charles Bean, he wrote that at the hour when it was thought probable the Germans would be sitting down to their midday feast, every gun of the British 4th and 5th Armies fired two rounds at the points where the enemy's troop and staff might be gathering.
Yeah, I think it's reflective of how the war had changed. Another important thing about 1914, the first year of the war, is that everyone had this feeling that the war would be over by Christmas. We've heard this expression so many times, and it's what people told their loved ones when they joined the army, and, you know, we'll get through this thing quickly and be home in time for Christmas. So when Christmas rolled around in 1914, it carried extra significance. But by Christmas 1915, and especially by 1916, the illusions have completely evaporated, and any thoughts that they may have had of camaraderie with their enemy and those sorts of things have gone out the window. And so you're right about that quote from Bean. And I also read one from a British soldier in 1915 who was told, his men were told on Christmas Eve, no fraternizing with the enemy. And he said, there was no chance of that. We actually snuck out into no man's land and caught a bunch of Jerry's laying barbed wire and we laid into them with the machine guns. So that was their Christmas present from us. So I think after a year of fighting and then 2 years and then obviously 3 and 4 years of fighting, the camaraderie between enemies had certainly died away.
And I presume, Matt, that when you talk about conflicts since World War One, and given the sophistication of the weapons as they got more and more sophisticated, Christmas Day would just be any other day.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been something that obviously in Christian nations it's been commemorated and armies recognise the importance of having a break from just perpetual horror. So Christmas has often been celebrated by troops around the world. But I think the First World War was unique in a number of ways. Firstly, the enemies were not too different. The Germans and the British and French were all fairly similar, from similar backgrounds, shared similar beliefs, but also just the proximity. In the First World War, they were literally 100 metres apart in the battlefield. So there was the opportunity then to actually see your enemy up close and to fraternise with him. In other conflicts and other wars, there simply wasn't that opportunity, even if you had the inclination, which I think many people didn't. So I think it was quite it's a fascinating chapter of history, because it was almost unique. The circumstances that made it happen were almost unique to that place and time on the Western Front in 1914.
And you can't imagine the Russians are going to let up on Ukraine come Christmas time, and the Ukrainians have got to keep up their garb. We spoke to one of the Ukraine politicians yesterday, Kira Rudik, and she said it's getting worse, the missile attacks on their infrastructure, particularly electricity, gas and water. So there'll be no Christmas break there, you wouldn't think.
No, it's a horrendous situation, isn't it? And I think one that we felt that we'd left in the past, this idea of land wars in Europe. Just a horrendous situation. So, I mean, I think all we can do is hope that going into 2023, we see some sort of relief for the poor Ukrainians.
As we go toward 2023, you've still got some great tours up for available for people who have an interest, like I do, in military history. Anzac Day, whereabouts? Western Front, Gallipoli, Kokoda, Hellfire Pass, or all of them?
Yeah, all those places. It's been really busy. 2022 was a bit of a transitionary year for people getting back into the way of travelling after COVID, but 2023 is looking very busy. So it's really wonderful to see that Australians have been keen to visit the battlefields and haven't lost that desire to go over there and walk the ground, and we're just really grateful that we get to do that with people. It's looking very busy, all those places you mentioned for Anzac Day, and then our regular tours throughout the year. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing that I get to do, walking the ground and showing these battlefields to people. A really special experience, and it's great. We're going to be doing more and more of that in 2023.
And you've got a new one, Battle Tactics on the Western Front?
Yeah, this one's really exciting. We had feedback that people wanted to explore the battlefields in a bit more detail. So it's a walking tour where we get out and actually follow specific battalions across battlefields. So it's a really, it's not overwhelming, but it just studies it in more detail. It tells the stories of the men on the ground, a lot of walking, getting the boots muddy, and getting out there walking in the footsteps of the men on the Western Front. So that's really exciting. In October next year, it's going to be a great trip.
So that's out of Paris, October 2023. Weather's still pretty good in October. It won't be, you know, warm, but it won't be cold and wet and snowy either.
Yeah, it's a good time, because the main reason we picked October is that there's no crops in the fields generally at that time. The farmers have done all their harvesting and are preparing for winter, so the fields tend to be empty, so you can get out and walk the ground. And there's a right to roam, they call it in France, where you're allowed to cross farmers' paddocks as long as you're not causing any damage. So it means we can get out and actually walk across the battlefields in the footsteps of those men. It's going to be extraordinary. It's a unique tour, and we're really excited.
I urge anybody to actually look up Matt McLaughlin's battlefield tours, because they are sensational. If you've got any interest at all in the history, and I can tell you, having done it with battlefield tours in Gallipoli and the Western Front, the feeling you have when you're walking that ground where so many young Australians lost their lives is quite sobering. Thank you very much, Matt. Thanks for your help this year. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Steve. Merry Christmas.
Good on you. Matt McLaughlin from Battlefield Tours. Feedback on electricity versus gas. Would you be happy for your household to go all electric? Jim is. He said, I've got a $100 switch that only allows our electric hot water to heat during the day when our panels are at their maximum. Our electricity bill was zero again. The new heat pump electric hot water units are much more efficient. I've seen electric hot water systems in the country that must be 50 years old. You wouldn't keep a fridge that long. I guess that's good, Jim, if you are in an area of Australia where you get lots of sun. Gail said, we were talking about this last night. I don't remember any house I've ever lived in that didn't have direct gas but bottled gas. Blake, gas is better for cooking. Shane, no way. In the bush, we need gas to cook with. We have converted our cooktops to gas in case of a blackout. Electricity is not reliable. Someone else said that to us earlier. Carmel said, no, just had new gas one installed. New. So what do you do to people who've just built a new house with gas in it? You're going to tell them to rip it out, are you, if you are Adam Bant and the Greens? Andy said, I'm not replacing my gas appliances with or without a subsidy. The shonky renewable grid will take 20 years to build and cost $1 trillion. Gas is not going anywhere anytime soon. And Ben said, instant electric hot water units are pieces of crap, but still manage to chew through a ton of kilowatts. So as usual, Canberra, the bubble, the Greens, never have to run anything. They just make this stuff up as they go along. John Lethlean is Australia's best food critic, joins us online. Are you cooking Christmas lunch, John?
No, I've done the smart thing, Steve. I've been invited over to a friend's house. How good is that?
Yeah, but you've got to take some of the less lean food with you, don't you?
No. I think I'll take some of the less lean cellar. I think it will be an occasion for some of those bottles that have been sitting there waiting for a special occasion. But, yes, I probably will end up taking something. Probably end up taking a pavlova, I think.
Now, this is controversial, what I'm about to say to you.
Mm.
WA rock lobsters are not a patch on southern rock lobster that you get in Tasmania and South Australia.
I agree.
Thank you.
Yeah, look, there's a reason they're cheaper. Now, we obviously can't get the southern rock lobsters over here. We get the western rock lobster mostly coming out of Geraldton, where your sister lives.
Yes, she's always got a fridge full of them.
Yeah, and they're not bad prices, but no, look, I as an expat Victorian, I totally agree that the southern rock lobster from Bass Strait around Tassie, and from around Robe in South Australia.
Oh yes,
just, one of the great crustaceans. Mate. There's no question. Yeah,
the best lobster I've ever had, fresh off a boat in Tassie on the Freycinet Peninsula. The boat pulled up. They pulled all the fresh lobsters out. They put about half a dozen of them in hot water and sold them. I grabbed a lobster. I grabbed a loaf of white bread, a bottle of Riesling, and a tub of butter, and I had the best lunch I've ever had in my life.
Oh, golly, that sounds good.
Oh.
That sounds absolutely good. I have had live lobster from, cooked pretty much straight from the boat, and it is an amazing thing, regardless of whether it's western or eastern or southern. I remember going on a scallop boat down there, exactly where you're talking about, just below the Freycinet Peninsula in Tassie once, and pulling scallop out of the water, which is a somewhat controversial thing these days with dredges and so on. But we had fresh raw scallops on the back of the boat at about 6 a.m. No Riesling, but they were amazing. There's nothing like that straight from the water experience, is there?
Well, you also did the cruise out of Hobart where you go to the oyster leases on the boat with the champagne, shucking your own oysters and slurping them down, did you not?
Oh, those were the days. These days it's just Vegemite sandwiches.
I don't believe that for a second. Now, the other thing people don't know is you're a big fan of Aldi.
I am.
You are a huge fan of Aldi because there's certain products you buy from Aldi. Natasha's here with us. She's an ambassador for Aldi, unpaid, but she talks them up all the time. Aldi's got two frozen lobster tails with garlic butter for $34.99.
I saw that.
Really? Where'd they get the lobster from?
I've got an Aldi.
WA.
I've got the Aldi app on my phone, so I get all sorts of messages.
what do you buy at Aldi again?
Well, coffee beans, which come from a very well-known roastery in Melbourne. But the coffee beans are a high quality and an absolute bargain.
Mm-hmm.
Aldi chocolate, no secret there. Everybody knows that Aldi chocolate is amazing. And their sliced Spanish ham, the jamón serrano.
John, it's really good. Pricey onto Aldi, and he has become obsessed. And one of the
I got
first,
a caravan cover.
And he doesn't have a caravan.
But it was on special.
Well, if I could tell you the number of things that I have bought in the center aisle over the
special
years
buys.
that I have never ever used. I remember buying a drill, a sort of a water pump that goes on the end of a power drill, thinking that'll be useful one day. But
I tell you what, I did get this year though, a cast iron roasting tray in green, which was about a tenth of the price of what you pay for Le Croisé or whatever that those other Frenchy ones are called.
Totally. Crofton. Why are Aldi not sponsoring this show?
I know. Exactly.
What price he's pushing for, John?
Crofton is their cookware brand.
How good is it?
I've got Crofton enamelware and I have got Le Creuset, and you're absolutely right. There's not a skerrick of difference between the two.
No.
At about a tenth of the price. Their cookware is amazing. So, The motto is you've just got to check in, you know, on a regular basis to see what on earth they're selling this week.
John, what about their champagne?
What about it?
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? I mean, it's
from France.
No, from Aldi.
Well, it can't be.
Yeah. It's a no, but is it real. It is real champagne. Yeah, it is. It is from the appellation that's allowed to call it. It's sparkling wine.
I bet John doesn't drink that. Quietly.
No, I do.
See?
I do. In my unemployed status, I have to watch.
Now that you're on the dole,
I have to wash the shekels. Yeah, they're bubbly. I'm just trying to remember the name of it, but it's well known that their bubbly is, you know, a very nice sparkling wine at about $29.
So you're sponging off the neighbours on Christmas Day. What's the menu?
Well, it's my good mate Rob Broadfield, who is.
Well, he's got his own winery, hasn't he?
No. He's got a. He's a journo in Perth, and has been. Done all sorts of things over the years, a little like yourself, Steve. He's been on radio and print and all. Anyway, Rob is a superb cook, and we're going down to his little holiday shack down at Preverley on the coast. And Rob will probably spend 3 weeks preparing lunch. He doesn't need to be outdoors, and whereas I need to be outdoors, I can't spend that much time. In the kitchen. And also, Rob lives in Perth, so he can buy the sorts of things that he needs. Down here, it's very hard to buy any sorts of things.
Any sparkling Burgundy going in the box to go down with you?
Yeah, see, I think sparkling Burgundy, you know, is probably a nullable thing, you know. Sparkling Burgundy doesn't cross the nullable. No, there's no following for it here. Just as there's no following for sherry here, which I find disappointing. Oh, I love sherry.
Natasha has one after the show every day.
Yeah, but you go into a bottle shop in WA and ask for sherry, and they'll produce some sort of, you know, sweet, ghastly thing in your. And no, I want a dry aperitif style sherry.
Yeah.
And they just look at you as if there's something, you know, something wrong with you. So, and sparkling Burgundy is the same, Steve. It's very much a sort of a South Australian Victorian thing. I think. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I raise it because I was in a bottle shop the other day and they had a Mornington Peninsula sparkling Burgundy that they were flogging, which I might buy some of. John, it's been a pleasure catching up with you as usual all year.
Yes.
I've just blown up my invitation to Geraldton because I've criticised WA rock lobsters. I won't be welcome there anymore. I can hear them complaining already. You look after yourself. Have a great Christmas and the rest of the year, mate. Lovely to catch up. We'll talk soon. I'll come and visit.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a great pleasure, mate.
Good
Take
on
it
you.
Easy.
John Lethley. Here's a prediction photograph on Twitter of in Victoria, the new legalised cannabis MPs. Yep. Two people got elected to the Victorian Parliament in the last election, and they were from the Legalised Cannabis Party. They're now in the upper house of the Victorian Parliament. A bloke called David Ettershank and a woman called Rachel Payne. They say legalising weed, as in marijuana, in Victoria this term is a realistic prospect. I am prepared to make a prediction. They're absolutely 100% right. Between now and when the Victorian people next go to an election in 4 years' time, marijuana, like it is in many states in the United States, will be legalised in small amounts for people for personal use. That's going to happen 100%. I don't think anyone ever thinks about the effect that regular use of marijuana, smoking marijuana, has on people's mental health. And they will regret it the day they do it, but it will happen.
And Woolworths has crunched the numbers on just how much Christmas food we are set to consume next week. The supermarket is expecting to sell $15 million worth of hams at its stores alone, 600 tons of prawns, 55,000 turkeys, and just shy of 3 million mangoes will be snapped up. And that's just my grocery bill, Steve.
Yes. Is it un-Christmassy, Grinch-like, to suggest, as I am about to, that I don't like turkey?
Yes, but it doesn't surprise me because
you like turkey?
Love turkey.
Dry and horrible.
No, it's not. I cook, this is going to blow your mind, a Moroccan turkey that is incredibly
beautiful.
Do we
import turkeys from Morocco? Okay. Really?
I do a special.
What are they, free range in Marrakesh or something?
No, I do a special little recipe with dakka. a spice.
With ducks. Ducks and turkeys.
I did hear an ad on, I heard this on the radio yesterday. No, hang on. And there was this new bird that's apparently out that's a chicken, a turkey. Have you heard about this?
Yes. No, it's not a new bird. It's a turducken. And what they do is they roll a turkey with a chicken with a duck into one thing.
Why?
I don't know, because they can, I suppose. So you debone the birds. You start, I think, the smallest bird of that would be the chicken, and then you put the duck, and then you put the turkey, and you roll it all up into a roll, and you roast it.
Why?
Haven't you never heard of a turducken?
No, but please don't swear. And also, why do you have to mix the flavours of three different things? Why can't you just stick with one, Steve?
Because turkey doesn't taste very nice. That's why.
No, you haven't had the right turkey with the right recipe. I just want to give you a bit of feedback. You know how we were talking about before?
About ads and how bad they are.
We had a lovely response saying, which is incredibly true. I'm just trying to find this right now.
So just while you're doing that, Cricket Australia apparently, according to a report on radio in Melbourne, has given media companies until this afternoon to submit their final bid for covering cricket in the next rights package.
Mm.
Nine's Zoe Samios states that the United States entertainment network Paramount that owns the Ten network in Australia is leading the race ahead of Seven and Nine and Fox after offering $1.5 billion, billion with a B, for the rights to test matches, one-day internationals and Big Bash over the next 7 years. Understood the bid exceeds those from Seven and Fox. However, the incumbents argue they can offer greater promotional coverage of the sport.
Big problem. Is that behind a paywall? Because Australians should not have to pay.
No, that'll be free to air on 10.
Will it?
Yeah, I'm 100%. That's the point that Foxtel, you obviously got to have a Foxtel account to watch it on Foxtel, but 10 is going to do it free to air. 10's coverage of the Big Bash League was better than anyone else's when they were doing it.
Originally, absolutely. Dave Barham was heading that coverage.
He's now the president of the Essendon Footy Club.
Yeah. Remember the Big Bash and then it was all families going out there? Okay. Lovely Nick R. said a response. We're talking about bad ads. And Nick R. is right. He said to me on Twitter, hang on, the Specsavers advertisements are the best. That's great. Should have gone to Specsavers.
That's a radio ad, isn't it?
No, it's on the television,
Steve. And who's on it?
They've got lots of different, and they have an accident or they don't see someone correctly and they say, should have gone to Specsavers.
Okay. Yep. You can come up with a few more for tomorrow and we'll hear from you then. Tasha, back tomorrow morning. Shane Sully is the Mayor of Greater Shepparton. Shane, good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good. How's your recovery going?
Yeah, really good. Yeah, it was a very challenging time from when the flood hit mid-October, and obviously by the time the river started to recede, during that period, we were able to, you know, get a lot of community support and rally behind those that really needed the assistance in the cleanup and other factors that come with these type of disasters. But so far, I couldn't be more proud of the way we've responded, and we're well and truly back open for business and looking forward to a strong summer ahead.
One of the issues you've got as a council, of course, is trying to repair the roads. 40% of the roads, as I understand it, were flood damaged. I don't want to put anyone off coming to Shepparton. You should go there. You just got to take care on the roads and try not perhaps travel at night, right?
Yeah, look, the main connection points to Shepparton, and I'm talking the Hume Highway, Golden Valley Highway and the Midland Highway, are open as per normal. And, you know, any significant damage that was caused through the flood event have definitely been repaired. So there is no loss of connection like there was during the flood. So, you know, we encourage people to come out, and especially if you're coming from Metro Melbourne, you know, it's a short two-hour drive north along the Hume and the Golden Valley Highway, and you'll find yourself in a beautiful place in the world. And like I said, connection here is no issue at all.
Well, do you ever? And you get access, of course. You can stay in Shepparton and access those beautiful parts of northeastern Victoria with all of the wineries, the golf courses, the river itself. It's a great part of the world. You don't need to convince me.
No, it is. Yeah, it is a special place. And we're so fortunate that a lot of our key tourist attractions weren't impacted through the flood event. And I'm speaking like the Museum of Vehicle Evolution, which is an unbelievable exhibition of classic and new cars, motorcycles, and a key piece that's been latest addition to them is the recognition to our transport industry here. A lot of people don't know that 25% of the trucks registered in Victoria are here in Greater Shepparton. We've got an avenue of legends that showcase the history of our transport industry here as well. And then, you know, our Shepparton Art Museum, that's a $50 million international standard museum here that's been recently built as well. So plenty of things to do, and our aquatic centre is up and running, and And we've obviously got the ultimate trampoline park, which is an indoor trampoline park, which is amazing. I've got young kids, and once I get in, you can't get them out. So plenty to do.
Music as well. You've used music to get people's mood up?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're looking for other events to take place into the new year, but we've been fortunate. Pre-floods, we had the Illuminate Festival here as well as White Night Festival, but we also recently just had our big Carols by Barrels event here, which a local pub puts on, a massive street party as well. We had our Fry Street Food Festival, which is in the middle of the CBD. We had about 30 different food trucks down here as well. So the community has really bounced back, and you know, my very clear message is, you know, come out and support a great place like Greater Shepparton, because you know, we're welcoming tourists back to our region and we're open for business.
And when you talk about food trucks in Shep, what you talk about, of course, is you've got such a multicultural community. You've got food from everywhere in the world.
We definitely are a multicultural community. We're made up of about 30 different nationalities that speak more than 50 languages. So very diverse. You won't have to go too far to experience a different part of the world with different food and culture here as well. So, yeah, if you're into that, and especially our Indigenous art precinct as well at SAM, we're the largest Indigenous community outside of Metro Melbourne as well. So plenty of culture and history here. There's a lot to do, especially over the upcoming summer school holidays.
Great part of the world. Good on you, Shane. Good luck with it, mate.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Shane Sarley there, the Mayor of Greater Shepparton.
Thanks for listening to this Australia Today podcast. For more of the news that affects you, download the Listener app and search Australia Today. Listener.